What you're saying is you're going to have 6 districts out of 7 always white, because that's our partisanship. That means blacks never have a chance, no matter what their number is, until they reach more than 51%.
Yep. That's what they're saying. And the Supreme Court is going to let them get away with it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Seems to me.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Welcome to the Bradcast. Coming up later this hour, Desi Doyen and our Green News Report. Hi, Des.
Hey.
As Donald Trump's cuts to the National Weather Service are now, as predicted, turning deadly. But first, I've got 2 guests standing by today. As we reported briefly yesterday, the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court held a nearly 3-hour oral argument on Wednesday regarding the future of one of the key tenets of, well, one of the last remaining otherwise largely intact sections of the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. After previously gutting Section 5, which required jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination in elections, to prove that their new election laws are not discriminatory. After that has been gutted, the right-wing majority now on the high court has ever since had its eye on Section 2 of the Act, which bars discrimination at the polling place in all 50 states. It has been a decades-long project of now Chief Justice John Roberts to dismantle the Voting Rights Act piece by piece, as we discussed with author and former top DOJ and U.S. court staffer Lisa Graves last week. He has been laser-focused on weakening the VRA since at least the 1980s, when he worked for the Ronald Reagan administration. After previously ruling that federal courts may have no say in partisan gerrymandering of U.S. House and legislative seats in the states a few years back, the Roberts Court is now eyeing Section 2's use as a counter to resist racial gerrymandering. But that, too, may be coming to an end based on the response from voting rights experts to Wednesday's oral argument at the court in Louisiana versus Calais. A case where white voters in Louisiana are calling U.S. House districts created by court order in states found to be in violation of Section 2 an unlawful racial gerrymander in violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause, even though such districts in question were ordered by the court in order to ensure voters in majority-minority areas are able to elect a representative of their choosing. The Section 2 remedy is designed to protect racial minorities in elections, but the group of white voter plaintiffs assembled to challenge the court-mandated creation of a second black majority voting district in Louisiana, several of whom, by the way, say they had no idea they were even listed as plaintiffs in the Supreme Court case. That group calls the creation of that second black voting opportunity zone an unconstitutional racial gerrymander that dilutes the voting power of white voters in the state. Voting rights advocates and other court watchers warned after Wednesday's hearing that the 6-3 Republican majority on the court appears ready to dismantle Section 2 in whole or in part, in a way that would wipe out dozens of such majority-minority voting districts, largely in the South, yes, the old Confederacy, and more than a dozen minority members of Congress in the bargain, most of whom just happen to be Democrats, of course. The AP reported it yesterday, the Supreme Court appeared ready to gut a key tool of the Voting Rights Act that has helped root out racial discrimination in voting for more than half a century, a change that would boost Republican electoral prospects, particularly across the South. AP notes that during more than 2.5 hours of arguments, the court's six so-called conservative justices seemed inclined to effectively strike down a black majority congressional district in Louisiana because it relied too heavily on race. Such an outcome would mark a fundamental change in the 1965 Voting Rights Law, the centerpiece legislation of the civil rights movement that succeeded in opening the ballot box to black Americans and reducing persistent, decades-long discrimination in voting. A ruling for Louisiana could open the door for legislatures to redraw congressional maps in southern states, helping Republican electoral prospects by eliminating majority black and Latino districts that tend to favor Democrats. Legislatures are already free to draw extremely partisan districts, subject only to review by the state courts, thanks to a 2019 Supreme Court decision referred to as Rucho. During oral arguments, the court's liberal justices focused on the history of the Voting Rights Act in combating discrimination, noting that getting to the remedy of redrawing districts only happens if, as Justice Elena Kagan said, a court finds, quote, a specific, identified, proved violation of law. That, lower courts have found, is exactly what happened to black voters in Louisiana, who make up more than 30% of the general population there. But where the Republican state legislature has historically drawn districts that pack most of those voters into a single voting district, and where the courts have now ordered a second majority-minority voting district for the U.S. House, the group of white voter plaintiffs are now complaining that they are being discriminated against. As Justice Sonia Sotomayor pointed out in this colloquy with an attorney representing the white plaintiffs.
Race is always a part of these decisions, and my colleagues are trying to tease it out in this intellectual way. What you're saying to us, if you use it to remedy past lingering discrimination, intentional discrimination, then you can't use it. You can use it to help yourself achieve goals that reduce a particular group's electoral participation.
Justice Sotomayor, my humble point is that the government has no business telling citizens in which districts they may live or what voting power they may
exercise. But it's not doing that, counsel. No one's keeping them out of that district. No one's stopping them from participating in the voting process. No one is stopping them from trying to run candidates or support candidates that reflect their views. But this state is stopping black voters from doing that in many districts because it's packing them into areas that whites overwhelm them.
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson argued that even if challengers have a problem with the remedy instituted by the court mandating that Louisiana now draw a second black opportunity voting district, the solution is not to gut Section 2 in its entirety. That all Section 2 does, as I understand it, is identify the problem, the unconstitutional race-based discrimination against black voters in this case, a problem that doesn't go away even if Section 2 even if Section 2 is struck down because it is blamed for identifying the problem that the courts have been trying to remedy.
Well, Justice Jackson, I think there's a reason why this court's voting precedents going all the way back to Shaw 1 are so tied up with race. It's because the remedy, as parties and the courts have understood Section 2 to operate, is almost always going to be race-based.
No, that's why they went. They're so tied up with race because that's the initial problem. The beginning is the claim that a person makes under Section 2 that because of their race, they are not being afforded equal electoral opportunity. It is a separate question as to how we go about remedying that and the extent to which we need to use race as a remedy. The Section 2 issue is just what circumstances do we look at to determine whether this problem of unequal electoral opportunity on the basis of race is occurring.
The plaintiffs and their right-wing representatives on the high court also seem to be arguing that, while discrimination against minorities in voting might have been a problem at one time, that, well, these laws meant to deal with them are now decades old. And, well, with all of the advances minorities have made, maybe we just don't need them anymore, as Republican Justice Brett Kavanaugh seemed to suggest as he pressed the NAACP civil rights lawyer Jenna Nelson on whether the time has come to simply end the use of race-based districts under the Voting Rights Act rather than, quote, allow it to extend forever.
The issue, as you know, is that this court's cases in a variety of contexts have said that race-based remedies are permissible for a period of time, sometimes for a long period of time, decades in some cases, but that they should not be indefinite and should have an endpoint.
Really? What endpoint? When the Republican justices on the court feel like they want to end them? Well, if we go by how the majority gutted Section 5 some years ago, I guess that endpoint is whenever they feel like they want to declare this to be the end. But the discrimination does not end. Nor does it matter, as Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson noted in her comparison of the Voting Rights Act to the Americans with Disability Act, whether the discrimination that occurs is carried out on purpose or if it is simply the effect of otherwise well-meaning districting laws.
Congress passed the Americans with Disabilities Act against the backdrop of a world that was generally not accessible to people with disabilities. And so it was discriminatory in effect because these folks were not able to access these buildings. And it didn't matter whether the person who built the building or the person who owned the building intended for them to be exclusionary. That's irrelevant. The idea in Section 2 is that we are responding to current day manifestations of past and present decisions that disadvantage minorities and make it so that they don't have equal access to the voting system. Congress is saying is if it is happening, which Section 2 gives us the tools to determine, you got to fix it.
You got to fix it. Unless, of course, you just strike down the law that says so. In this matter, the Roberts Court has asked the parties to answer the fundamental question, quote, whether the creation of a second majority-minority congressional district in Louisiana violates the 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution by violating the rights and voting power of white voters, seemingly turning those two amendments and the Voting Rights Act itself meant to enforce them on its head. Louisiana and the Trump administration joined with the group of white voters in arguing to invalidate the majority-minority district in question, thereby making it much more difficult, if not impossible, to claim discrimination in redistricting. The arguments led Justice Sonia Sotomayor to assert that the administration's, quote, bottom line is just get rid of Section 2. If that happens, as many experts now seem to expect, it would, as noted, most likely result in the loss of more than a dozen minority representatives in Congress, leading to the perhaps even more disturbing question of when the court might issue such a ruling and whether it would be in time to undermine the critical 2026 midterm elections in which Democrats had hoped to win back a majority in the U.S. House in order to begin putting the brakes on the Trump administration's runaway authoritarianism. Joining us now to help us make sense of all of this, if there is any sense to be made of it, are two guests, longtime guests here on the show and longtime experts who we've turned to many times over the years regarding both election laws, such as the Voting Rights Act, and the right-wing weaponization of both political and racial gerrymandering. to gain and hold on to political power. Joshua A. Douglas teaches and researches election law and voting rights at the University of Kentucky College of Law. He's joined us on the program a number of times over the years. His 2019 book is Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. And his newest is The Court Versus the Voters, the troubling story of how the Supreme Court has undermined voting rights. He is also the host of the award-winning Democracy Optimist podcast and newsletter. We will see how optimistic he is today. Josh Douglas, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And our friend David Daly is a senior fellow at fairvote.org. His latest 2024 bestseller is called Anti-Democratic: Inside the Right's 50-Year Plan to Control American Elections, a plan that truly now seems to be coming to fruition, especially this week. David Daly, welcome back as well to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Josh, I want to focus on the legal aspects with you and perhaps more of a political aspect with David, though I suspect you each have thoughts on both, because I think both matters are sort of hopelessly intertwined in this matter. Josh, this case came to the court in sort of a circuitous and unusual way, as I understand it. It was actually requested by the court itself. Am I right about that? Can you explain, without digging too deeply into the weeds, how we got here in that regard? And if I just generally correctly characterize the issue and the stakes in my intro there in general.
Yeah, you did. And you're right that this is a little bit of a convoluted case. I'll briefly just walk through how we got here, which is that after the last census, Louisiana drew a new congressional map, and it had only one of the six districts that was majority Black. Yet Louisiana has a population that's about one-third minority. And so just sort of the math would think, well, you're likely, depending on how you draw the map and where people live, you'd assume a third of the people being minority voters, you'd maybe get two of the six districts. Mm-hmm. And so plaintiffs challenged the map, and they won under this provision you discussed in the introduction, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It's not so simple as just saying, well, you have a third of the voters are Black, and therefore you should get a third of the seats. There's a lot of proof that the plaintiffs have to bring to show historical discrimination, to show that the map that was drawn actually suppresses minority votes. They actually tried to draw it in a way that you would not get the two majority Black districts. And so there was a violation found. And so Louisiana then drew a new map and said, okay, we need to fix the Section 2 violation. So it drew a new map where two of the six seats were majority Black. And so now you have these white plaintiffs who file suit and say, hold up, you can't think about race too much. And that you know, when you're drawing the map, race can't be your primary or predominant consideration. And Louisiana, initially, in defending its map, this second map where the two of the six districts said, no, we weren't thinking about race. We were thinking about politics. We were trying to protect two Republican incumbents. And so, yes, we had to fix the Section 2 violation and give a second majority Black district, but we also wanted to do so in a way that protected our incumbents as much as possible. Mm-hmm. The white plaintiffs weren't satisfied, and they say, no, you thought about race too much. And this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court last term. And the argument then was basically, okay, did Louisiana consider race too much or not, or was politics part of the conversation? And then at the end of the term, the court refuses to issue a decision. It takes several weeks to tell us why. And then it says we were going to request or require a re-argument where we address whether Section 2 itself is unconstitutional. That is, if the violation here that the courts found of Section 2 means that the state has to consider race in its line drawing, then is that consideration in and of itself a violation of the U.S. Constitution? So this is the re-argument here where the court signaled, hey, we might strike down Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and the parties were asked to brief and then argue that question.
And how unusual is that, by the way, for the court to say, okay, great, thank you for bringing that particular challenge, but we want you to go away and bring a different question entirely back to us.
It is pretty unusual, but the biggest, most prominent example we have is the Citizens United case.
Yep.
Right, where the court in a campaign finance issue was looking at a very narrow statutory interpretation, and then at the end of the term, surprised everyone by saying, hold up, we're going to have a re-argument and ask whether this federal campaign finance law is unconstitutional, and then re-argued, had that re-argument, and we all know what happened there with respect to the court really embellishing corporate and union rights to spend money on politics and their political campaigning, and really transformed the whole way that campaign finance works. So it's a very troubling signal when the court did this time around, because we know what happened the last time it did something like this.
David Daley, is it fair to say that while the Supreme Court recently washed its hands of partisan gerrymandering, saying that federal courts had no business preventing that, that it is an issue should be, you know, left up to the state legislatures and state courts, that here they now seem to be suggesting that they're preparing to wash their hands of adjudicating racial gerrymanders as well? I mean, it seems to be the exact same thing they did with the partisan gerrymandering, begging the question of, if they did so, would there be any curbs on that practice at all left over?
I think that's right. If you go back to the Shelby County decision that effectively froze preclearance back in 2013.
The Section 5 case,
That's right. The Roberts Court said, well, we don't necessarily need Section 5 because we still have Section 2. And then they slowly set about eroding Section 2. Mm. Case by case. And I think you can see that they're doing something similar on gerrymandering. That back in 2019 in the Rucho versus Common Cause case, what was a moment where you had federal courts nationwide appointed, you know, judges appointed by presidents of both parties, looking at partisan gerrymanders drawn by Democrats in Maryland and Republicans in Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Michigan, and saying, we have the tools to adjudicate this. And also, if we don't, nobody else will, because you have the very nature of partisan gerrymandering is that politicians are locking themselves in office. And the Roberts Court looked at this, and in a 5-4 decision, they not only effectively turned aside all of those federal judges, but closed the federal courts to partisan gerrymandering claims. They said it was a non-justiciable political issue. Well, that misunderstands how gerrymandering works. Or if it doesn't misunderstand it, perhaps it's quite intentional, because I think the Chief Justice is a fairly smart and educated person who understands the political effects of this all too well, and the side that these political effects accumulate toward. And what you could see, I think, in Justice Alito's formulation yesterday was an extension, really, because once you have said that partisan gerrymandering cannot be adjudicated by the courts, you have effectively liberated state legislatures to draw maps that are as gerrymandered as they like. Then to say that what they've done is to draw a gerrymander, not for racial purposes, but for party.
Right. It might be a racial gerrymander, but we didn't do it for racial reasons. We did it because we think it will help us politically.
And this is what North Carolina was saying. You had lawmakers standing up and saying, we're not drawing a racial gerrymander here. We're doing a partisan gerrymander. And this is what Alito was talking about yesterday as well. If Louisiana just draws a 6-0 Republican map, maybe they can just get up there and say they're doing it for partisan purposes and that it had nothing to do with race at all. And it goes back to all of these questions of effect versus intent, which have been part of, you know, the Voting Rights Act debate ever since, you know, Mobile v. Bolden back in the late 1970s and early 1980s, which was the heart of the Voting Rights Act reauthorization debate in 1982, in which John Roberts played such a crucial role. And now it's back again, right? With Roberts not as the 26-year-old young Department of Justice aide, but as the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
And this effect versus intent issue, as that came up, I think the liberal justice were trying to point out it doesn't matter whether they intended it for it to be racially discriminatory. The effect is that it is, and therefore the law mandates that it be corrected in some fashion. And by the way, I was
and that was the fight that John Roberts lost in 1982.
82, right.
Except now he's in a position to, a much different position in which he does not need to convince 51 senators and 218 representatives to his side, as he was trying to do as a Reagan aide back in 82. He only has to, bring along five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Have six.
Josh Douglas, I was sort of struck on that point, how the Republican justices seem to regard partisan gerrymandering at this point as, oh, that's just fine. Republican-controlled legislatures, they can gerrymander to keep Democrats out of power all they want, or Republicans out of power in the reverse case where Democrats control the state legislature. And all of that, that's just fine. It's even laudable. That seems to me to be a very different idea than what we would have heard in this court at almost any time over the past 60 years or so, until the recent court ruling said that, in Rucho, I guess, that said that they had no problems with partisan gerrymandering, that it was a matter to be left to the state courts to worry about. And so as long as you claim it's partisan gerrymandering, you're fine. Is that the case they were making? Because it was kind of troubling to hear during those arguments.
Yeah, and this is why I think actually the Rucho case from 2019 is going to go down as probably one of the worst cases for modern democracy. You know, set aside the cases that that allowed for racism, of course, but in terms of the modern era, after the revolution and the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s that got us to a place of much more equality, I think today we're going to, in future years, we'll look at the Rucho case as really one of the most dangerous and harmful cases to modern democracy. And I actually think this is where the decision's going to go. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to outright strike down Section 2 as unconstitutional. It didn't do so in 2021 in a case out of Arizona called Brnovich, which it had an opportunity to construe Section 2 as it applies to vote denial claims of, outright prohibiting people from voting. Instead, the court, and it was Justice Alito who did it, essentially made up the law. He came up with these so-called guideposts for lower courts to apply in a Section 2 case about a voting practice. And every single one of these guideposts makes it virtually impossible for plaintiffs to win these cases. And the data we've seen since that decision has borne that out, that plaintiffs are having a very hard time bringing a Section 2 claim. I think the same thing is going to happen with Section 2 and redistricting. And it's all because of that Rucho case.
Well,
Go ahead.
Well, no, because I want to loop back in a moment to both of you for not only what we think will happen, but what effects it will have. But I'm still trying to sort of understand, where the justices are even coming from, or if this is simply just a matter of, making up an argument to reach the ends they want to reach anyway. The court recently, for example, determined that race-based college administration admission practices meant to counter decades of discriminatory practices at the nation's colleges and universities, that is now lawful. And many have cited that ruling in that case and have compared so-called majority-minority opportunity voting districts to that practice at colleges, which has now been ruled unlawful, unconstitutional, and suggesting that it's the same thing with voting, and that too, therefore, is unconstitutional. What's your response to that argument, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, this is a long-term project of the court to basically say that you can never make racial distinctions in any sort of area of the law, and that obviously ignores our long history as a country, and in particular with respect to voting. I mean, the whole point of the Voting Rights Act was to root out discrimination on the basis of race. Mm-hmm. And when the court in 1980 said, we think Section 2 means only intent. You simply can't have an intent to discriminate. Congress came back in 1982 and said, no, we meant effect. We meant that you can't have a law that results in discrimination on the basis of race. And what I think the court is signaling now is that, you know, it's not going to say, again, this is my prediction, but it's not going to say Section 2 is unlawful. It's going to say, well, if you're thinking about politics, that means by definition you can't be thinking about race. So it's going to insulate these states from drawing lines that have a disproportionately harmful effect on minority voters by letting them defend on the idea that it's just partisanship, it's just politics,
which it seems insane to me. And frankly, it sort of turns all of this, the Voting Rights Act, the post-Civil War 14th and 15th Amendments, sort of on their head. Those amendments gave Congress, not the courts, but Congress the right, in fact, the mandate, in fact, to write legislation to enforce those amendments against racial discrimination. They didn't include a time limit. It didn't say unless the judges don't like the way they do it. But it seems like the court is now saying that Congress, even though Congress, it took them almost a century later to act on those amendments and to write that into law in enacting the Voting Rights Act, that somehow Congress, in doing that, in enforcing the Constitution, that is somehow unconstitutional. David Daley, am I?
No, you're exactly right. Entered the upside down, right? The Constitution and the Voting Rights Act, the idea is that this is a guarantee of equality. And they are turning it upside down and claiming that it, in fact, perpetuates racial injustice. It's opposite day.
Yeah.
But I think what's important to understand is that this is part of a long project that has extended over decades, that is now reaching its culmination, and that there has always been in this nation and at this U.S. Supreme Court, as well as previous courts, mm-hmm. Including the court, you know, back in the 1870s, that did so much to quash the dream of Reconstruction and to sweep in the era of Jim Crow that it took the Voting Rights Act to unravel and to restore the dream of multiracial democracy, that there has always been this kind of impatience. You know, even back in the 1870s, when talking about the Civil Rights Act cases, you had justices on the court saying, well, how much longer does this special treatment have to go on
right.
for? And I think you hear that same impatience at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yep.
And that you have heard it for a long time, that the 1980 Mobile v. Bolden case that begins to lay out these questions of intent versus effects, right, is in some ways the beginning of this. It's the beginning of the backlash, because you have a court that is saying in that case, well, you can't get inside the head of these lawmakers. You don't know what they were thinking when you drew these city council districts in Mobile. Therefore, you can't do anything to remedy it. And Congress steps up, as Josh said, and very specifically says, actually, you're wrong. We intend anything that has the effect of perpetuating racial discrimination mm-hmm. to qualify here yeah. as unconstitutional. And we have that right. And it was John Roberts who was on the other side of that argument. It is Roberts in the Reagan Justice Department who is making the case, and there's hundreds of pages of his memos in the National Archives, and they are well worth a read. That argues that the effect test mm-hmm. Should not be, you know, part of the VRA. Mm-hmm. This was John Roberts' contention, and Roberts lost that
right.
fight. But the fight moves. The fight moves from Congress and the White House and public opinion into the courts, where you don't have to have 51 senators or 218 reps to carry the day.
And
you
where
only
now
we need these five. And now the same people are in charge, and they are whittling this away in ways that Congress never, ever intended, but ways in which this cabal inside the conservative legal movement have wished to see happen now for decades upon decades.
Josh Douglas, to David's point there about, about the idea that I played Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, in that clip during the intro, where he seemed to be arguing that race-based problems and solutions are, they're fine for a while, but unlike, I guess, every other law in the world, or in the country, those that deal with race, for some reason, that they have a use-by date or something. I mean, it was a very similar argument that John Roberts, in fact, wrote in the case that effectively gutted the use of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act back in 2013. Is there any actual legal basis, to your knowledge, Josh, that laws meant to deal with racial discrimination, that they must have some sort of a time limit? And if they don't, the justices on the Supreme Court can simply declare time's up, because that kind of feels where we're going again.
I'd love to know where he comes up with that. I mean, and judges aren't supposed to make laws, the saying goes. And,
right.
Those who study law know that judges do so-called make law all the time when they have to provide interpretation for something that might be ambiguous. But this is just pulled out of thin air. There was a little bit of a hook for this idea in the Shelby County case in 2013 because Congress itself had put an end date on Section 5 and saying, here's where we need this extra oversight of these states that have a history mm-hmm. of discrimination. So there was, some law there in that at least Congress, when creating that prophylactic measure, also put an end date to it. In one of the earlier affirmative action cases in 2003, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had said, I'm going to approve the use of affirmative action in law school admissions now, but I think maybe in about 25 years, we hopefully won't have the need for it anymore. She kind of made it up, and she was widely criticized for putting a timestamp on when you might no longer need affirmative action. And Kavanaugh here is, latching on to really nothing in suggesting that, we need to end this kind of protection. I mean, I think all of us agree that we'd love at some point to end the protection, but that end should come when we're not discriminating on the basis of race any longer. And,
right.
and it reminds me of one of Chief Justice Roberts' famous lines in one of the affirmative action cases, in which he said, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, as in making it, making distinctions. But that's just not borne out by reality.
Right.
The reality is we have structural racism, so we can't just ignore it.
Right. We can end it when it ends, but until it ends, we can't end it unless, by the way, Congress puts on an expiration date, which they have not in this case, as far as I can tell. All right. I've got just a minute or two left here. I want to ask both of you a couple of questions. If, in fact, the court does strike down Section 2, never mind when they do that. We'll get to that in a second. But if they strike it down, or part of it, as far as racial gerrymandering goes, what happens thereafter? If we don't have Section 2 to rely on for this, let me go to Josh first on that.
I mean, I think we're going to see a lot more states engage in this so-called mid-decade redistricting that we're already seeing. Some states do this in response to President Trump trying to make sure that he doesn't lose the House in the midterm elections. So you have California, Texas, Missouri, North Carolina just announced new maps.
Mm-hmm.
And some states are not doing it because they know that if they try to gerrymander their maps more, they're going to have a Section 2 lawsuit, right? The only way to gerrymander the map is to dilute minority voting strength. And so Section 2 here serves as a deterrent. And when that is no longer around, whether it's the court strikes it down as unconstitutional or narrows its interpretation so much that it's so hard to win, I think you're going to see a lot more states, Louisiana included, that redraw their maps. And what this is going to mean is that you're going to have a much more partisan skew. And I think Dave could probably talk to the actual political ramifications. Mm-hmm. But my sense is that it's going to be even that much harder for Democrats to take back the House in 2026, just because race and party are so closely aligned in many states, particularly in the South.
David, what do you see?
This would be an electoral bonanza for the Republican Party. And it would be what we're seeing right now is happening on two tracks. There is this mid-decade, really an unprecedented gerrymandering Armageddon that is taking place, starting in Texas, and it has spread into Missouri, Kansas, North Carolina, Indiana, Ohio. It could continue into New Hampshire and Kentucky. Republicans, through mid-decade partisan gerrymandering, likely to gain as many as 10 to 12 seats. And I'm not counting Texas here, because I think Texas and California could balance each other out. But in the other states, and I would include Florida there, I think it's possible that you could still see this in Nebraska, about a dozen seats net gain for the Republican Party. Mm. And folks are saying somewhere between 12 and 19 seats potentially accruing to Republicans if this decision comes down in time for states to remap ahead of 2026. Yeah, I would suggest that this court's intention is to do that. I think that's why they scheduled it so early. I think Josh smartly pointed out that Citizens United is the other example of this. The Citizens United decision came down in January.
Well, all of this, I mean, talk about judicial activism. All of this smacks of judicial activism when they know that based on their ruling, they could be flipping essentially anywhere from, 12 to 19 seats in the U.S. House. That doesn't even get us to the state legislative matter. But yeah, as far as when this decision, when this ruling, if everyone is right about this, that in fact they are going to either strike it down or greatly limit it in some fashion so that it's all but unusable. You're suggesting, David Daly, that they are going to make this decision in January of next year in time to affect next year's elections, rather than waiting to normally we wouldn't have a ruling on this until June or July of next year.
I don't think they'll wait until the last week of June. I think they ordered this case re-argued for a reason, because they wanted to take on these big constitutional questions. They have the opportunity to do so. They scheduled it for very early in the term. It's very similar to what the court did with Citizens United when they scheduled it for re-arguments. Got it up really early in the session, decided it at the end of January. It would not surprise me if the same schedule happened again.
Josh Douglas, your thoughts, and please, I hope you dispute what David has to say on that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's probably right that we're not going to be waiting until June to get a decision. Maybe February. But here's the wrinkle. When the court asked for the re-argument and put the oral argument for mid-October, we didn't have this big push for mid-decade redistricting underway just yet. And so I do wonder, is the court seeing partisan gerrymandering run rampant just on the politics of it in Texas and California and mm-hmm. Missouri and North Carolina, et cetera, whether the court might, and this is where, I'm a half glass full type of person, and, maybe the court will say, okay, we were going to rush this earlier because we wanted to let states get out of the strictures of Section 2. Not thinking that every state in the country might be engaged in redistricting in early 2026, which would throw a huge wrench in the process. The other thing to recognize is the election calendar. So although the midterm is in November, you got to worry about the primaries,
right,
which are often in the spring, and then the filing deadlines are earlier than that. So even a decision in January or February might make it difficult for some states to react and draw new lines unless they also push back their filing deadlines and their primaries. So I think it's complicated. I don't think it's a certainty that this decision will cause every state to redraw their lines, but I would not be surprised if that is what happens.
Or if it's just some states, say those down in the South, these laws were meant to guard against in the first place. Anyway,
I think we can name the states, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, yep. Texas will go further.
Yeah.
And can we just create a new phrase here for what's going on? I'm going to call this Rucho rigging, right? I think this all goes back to the Supreme Court's decision in Rucho saying politics is perfectly fine, a perfectly justifiable defense. And even now, potential defense for racial discrimination. This is Rucho rigging.
I would go one step further. I think we ought to call this Roberts mandering.
There you go. Or
because
Roberts
that's really
rigging.
What this is, you know? And so I would quarrel slightly with my friend Josh on that point, right? Because I don't think the court is going to look at what's happening in these states and say, oh, maybe we went too far. The court hasn't looked at anything that's happened on voting rights since Shelby County in any of these states and said, oh, well, maybe we went too far. Maybe things had not changed in the South as much as we wanted. The Roberts Court enabled what's happening right now. It unleashed it.
And I hate to jump in here, David, but I got to get out. I'm afraid to say not only did they enable it, they may be celebrating it after the first of the year. We will see.
Entirely possible.
I'm hoping Josh is right, that it is not in time to rewrite all the maps for 2026. But I don't know. I haven't been lucky lately. I got to get out, guys. David Daly is from a senior fellow at fairvote.org. You can find him on the blue skies at Dave Daly. Daly is spelled D-A-L-E-Y. His latest book is called Anti-Democratic, Inside the Right's 50-Year Plan to Control American Elections, which seems to be playing out right now. And Joshua A. Douglas is the professor of constitutional law and election law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. You can find his work at joshuaadouglas.com. And of course, his latest book is The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. You can also watch that playing out live right now. And his podcast is Democracy Optimist.com. Thank you, guys.
Thanks
anytime.
So much.
Thank you.
Okay, we got to take a quick break here. There is some breaking, if not unexpected, news that has happened over the last few minutes as I've been speaking with Josh and David. Let me take a quick look at that. We'll have that and Desi Doyen's Green News Report straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. My thanks again to Josh Douglas and Dave Daly. Before we get to our latest Green News report, some breaking news. As noted, not unexpected, but Donald Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, that would be his third after he had fired the first two during his first term. John Bolton was charged on Thursday in a federal investigation for allegedly mishandling of classified information, according to several outlets who sent alerts, as I noted, as we were speaking with Josh and Dave. NBC reports the indictment charges Bolton with 8 counts of transmission of national defense information and 10 counts of retention of national defense information. The probe into Bolton, who served for more than a year in Trump's first administration before he was also fired in 2019, the investigation became public back in August this year when Trump's FBI searched Bolton's home in Maryland and his office in Washington for classified records that he may have held on to from his years in government. Now, if anybody knows anything about unlawfully hanging on to classified records after leaving office. That, of course, would be Donald Trump. He was charged with stealing thousands of highly classified documents upon leaving office and then refusing multiple times to return them to the government in a case that ultimately went away because he became president again. Bolton's indictment, according to AP now, sets the stage for a closely watched case centering on a longtime fixture in Republican foreign policy circles who became known for his hawkish views on American power, to say the least, and who, after leaving Trump's first government, emerged as a prominent critic of the president, declaring that he was unfit for office, which, of course, is why he's now being prosecuted by the Trump administration, though it should be noted that the case against Bolton actually began reportedly before Trump's second term. So there could be some legitimacy to this particular case, unlike those, as far as I can tell, against Trump's former FBI director, James Comey, the sitting Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, both similarly regarded as political enemies by Trump. But whether or not Bolton really deserves to be charged here, well, that question will now be inextricably tied up with him being on Trump's enemies list, which, by the way, is why presidents are supposed to stay the hell out of law enforcement matters at the DOJ. In other words, Bolton might really have done what he's now being accused of and indicted for, but many will regard this as just the latest hit job by Trump's corrupted, weaponized Department of Justice, whether it actually is or not. So much for blind justice and the rule of law under this president. All right, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
The high winds brought a 6 to 10 foot storm surge in these low-lying coastal areas, damaging and destroying almost every home in several indigenous communities.
Trump cuts to National Weather Service resulted in faulty forecast of deadly Alaska storm. Trump EPA canceled flood control upgrades for Alaskan tribes hit hard by that storm. Plus, Trump is trying to pressure other nations to ditch clean energy, but many aren't listening.
That's a whole lot of Trump. Sorry in advance. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Gavin Newsom, he's got to get his act together because now you already lost 25,000 houses to fires, and that should have never happened because they should have had the water flowing in from the Pacific Northwest. All they had to do is open up the valves. He didn't want to do it.
Are you still lying about that? Stop lying about us out here in Los Angeles, Mr. President. You loser. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, can't the guy just go back to lying about Jeffrey Epstein or something? Leave us out of it?
I wish.
What do you got for us today?
Well, first, a disturbing follow-up to the remnants of that typhoon that battered multiple coastal communities in western Alaska over the weekend, causing widespread damage and deadly catastrophic flooding. Officials say every home is damaged. The Coast Guard rescued 24 people from homes swept out to sea. The remoteness of the area has complicated emergency rescue and response. Officials are scrambling to get more than 1,500 people to safety as more storms move in, with victims in need of long-term emergency housing likely hundreds of miles away.
And will the National Weather Service actually give them accurate forecasts this time, or is there no one left in the offices?
Well, CNN reports that the forecast for that powerful and deadly storm was likely made worse by a lack of weather data caused by the Trump administration's mass layoffs at the National Weather Service.
Huh, go figure. Who could have seen that coming?
It prevented weather balloon launches that could have helped warn those communities that the storm was headed directly their way. Even worse, the New York Times reports that 5 months ago, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency canceled a $20 million flood protection grant that would have protected the Alaska native village of Kipnuk from extreme flooding, calling it, quote, wasteful DEI spending.
Canceled for DEI.
Yes. Kip Nook saw catastrophic flooding and was severely damaged. And yes, man-made climate change was a factor. Meteorologists say that the storm was sustained by record-warm North Pacific Ocean waters much farther north than it was forecast. In a different Native American community in Arizona, the Trump administration canceled a $25 million grant to fund solar panels and battery storage for more than 600 homes on the Hopi Tribe Reservation, where many have no access to grid electricity. But the Trump EPA terminated the Solar for All program created by the Biden-era Inflation Reduction Act, calling that program wasteful, and it halted all future funding for the program, including money that had already been set aside for tribes.
Well, at least he didn't call it DEI, I guess.
In international news, the world's largest maritime nations gathered in London this week to consider new regulations that would move the ocean shipping industry away from fossil fuels, including enacting the first ever global fee on greenhouse gas emissions that cause dangerous man-made climate change. Experts say it would be a major win for the climate, public health, the ocean, and marine life. But the Trump administration has unequivocally rejected the proposal and threatened to retaliate against any nations that vote in favor of it with sanctions and visa restrictions.
Jesus.
Trump is also pressuring foreign nations to ditch their transition to clean energy and buy more U.S. fossil fuels. But the Washington Post reports that in countries like India, officials are turning away from natural gas for electricity because renewable energy is cheaper, more reliable, and doesn't depend on overseas nations for fuel. Pakistan, over just 6 years, has imported so many rooftop solar panels that capacity now equals that of the national electricity grid. A new analysis by the International Energy Agency projects that global renewable power capacity will double in 5 years. In an interview with the All In podcast, venture capitalist Chamath Palihapitiya explained that new gas plants just take too long to come online.
You know, these are 10-year projects. And so even if you say go from today, the earliest these things can be turned on really in 2032, 2033. That's far too late. The reality is it is faster and more efficient to put solar panels up and start generating electricity.
Is it 2029 yet?
No.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do. Yes, we do. we gotta get out of this place. We're running late. Thanks again to Josh Douglas of the University of Kentucky, Dave Daly of fairvote.org, our producer every day, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. You can download our shows anytime for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you who hit a donate button or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the social medias, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. You will find Desi
at Green News Report.
We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.